Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
We're expecting Tosin Anufuaken to join us in a few minutes, and we'll put him on when he does. But until then, this week, Kim.com is back with Mega. FCC wants gigabit broadband nationwide. A sneak peek at the new BlackBerry OS, Firefox phones, and more. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And this week, there's a few things that I've been playing with. I'm trying to organize my Blu-ray collection, because right now I don't have shelves that the Blu-rays go on. I put them in like big canvas bins, and those bins go in shelves themselves. And I recently ran across the situation where they're out of sight, out of mind. I can't see the actual physical Blu-rays. I've been double buying Blu-rays, so I'll see a great deal, a deal that I can't resist, you know, like a $5 or $6 Blu-ray.
You are the epitome of American decadence.
Yes.
You're going to buy the same piece of aluminum and plastic over and over again.
Well, so this is a problem. So I desperately needed some way of sort of cataloging what I had so that I can see it at a glance. So I was looking through like apps or other programs for my Mac that might help me. And on the Mac, there's this one program that is like highly regarded across the board called Delicious Library. But and it seemed like a good solution, but Delicious Library had no way of sort of entering in the information automatically. You have to like hand code it in there. And what I was looking for was something specifically where I can just scan the UPC and have it automatically go in. Delicious Library actually offers that, but they do it not through your phone, which was the ideal sort of situation, through a phone camera, but through an optional $150 barcode scanner. I'm like, that's
what?
That's ridiculous.
Is it a USB barcode scanner?
I think it's a Bluetooth barcode scanner.
What?
Yeah, which is kind of ridiculous. So I went lower tech than that, and there's an app on the made by this company called Involos called DVD Profiler. And it's an app.
You get a USB barcode scanner for $29.98.
Yeah, no. This one just uses the camera on the back of your iPhone or iPad to scan the UPC and automatically brings up the all of the information and the cover art and all of that. And it seems to be working fine so far. I've got like about 50% of my catalog scanned in so far.
That's great, dude.
Yeah.
That's great. And you can just search it once you're done?
You can just search it. You can filter it by any number of different categories. Filter it by Blu-ray or DVD. And the other thing, you can also create a lending library where you can loan it out to somebody and you check them out and check them back in.
That's key.
Yeah.
You lose your stuff by lending it out.
Totally.
Can you do that with books, too? Is it only for DVDs or can you, like, do it with a book?
This particular one is configured specifically for DVD and Blu-rays, for basically video media on disk.
Okay. I'd like something that does everything that I own with a barcode.
That's what you're looking for, is Delicious Library, except for the barcode part. It won't do the barcode. It will do it, but you have to, it will do it through the iSight camera on your Mac. But if you want to, but that means that you have to physically bring your Mac to your collection, which is what I was trying to avoid. You can't just have some sort of handheld solution with Delicious Library without paying an extra $150.
Right. I guess, yeah, because I have a humongous library of physical books. You know, a friend comes over, borrows it, I never see it again. And then I've got the obviously I have a ton of, I too have a lot of Blu-rays and discs, but those are actually all in a storage bin far, far away from.
Right, because you were telling me about how you do it, which seems to be a more sort of 21st century digital distribution sort of method of.
Right, so like everybody else who was a kid, like teenager in the 90s, during the 90s and the early 2000s and everything, you know, I joined like Sony and BMG and all those other like media companies that had their distribution schemes. You know, you get 9 free and then you get like, you know, you spend like $20 on the other 4, negative option continuity, all that crap. So I ended up with a lot of DVDs, and then later on I ended up with a lot of Blu-rays. And I think I've spoken about this before. Basically, in the beginning of 2012, I took it all and I put together a scheme of ripping, encoding, gathering metadata, basically a cocktail that a friend and I put together. That basically between physical discs and other things, took everything. It sits on, you know, a couple 3 terabyte drives that are in series, and it basically is hanging out attached to a Macintosh, which is running iTunes. Everything is all MP4'd out. Mm-hmm. And you know, my Apple TV can see it. And the best part is now that I'm at this place, what I typically do is I've gotten to a point where Christmas time, you can't really buy me anything except for like iTunes or Amazon gift certificate-y things.
Uh-huh.
So I can go and, you know, I don't want to buy the physical media anymore. I'll buy it from Amazon. Because what I found was you buy the physical media, you buy the DVD, the Blu-ray comes out, you want it on Blu-ray. But if you buy it from iTunes, you get it in whatever quality is the top available right then. You know, so if you bought a 720p, I mean, you have to go for HD, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But if I bought the HD version of something, then it's going to give it to me in both in 720p or in 1080p. Right? It doesn't care. Mm-hmm. It's not going to say 1080p. Well, we'll see what happens when the 8K stuff begins being distributed. But I like the idea that there's some level of upgradability, because when I had the Apple TV 2 and I got rid of it for the Apple TV 3, all the stuff that I had bought that was in 720p was suddenly available to me in 1080p without me having to pay any more money, which is kind of a nice thing. But yeah, so I'm all about the conversion stuff. I can give you my cocktail secrets. Maybe one day I'll write them down.
That would be terrific. Well, maybe at some point when you write them down, we'll share them with our audience here. They would help them out on their pursuits.
Yeah, man. I mean, if you have I was doing it with Handbrake on Windows for a little bit, but then I realized if you do it on OS X, there are a couple specific tools that really help you do it all hands off. So there's that.
The other things that I've been playing with this week are a couple of game apps for iOS, sandbox game apps, and one is called Topia. And Topia basically gives you this environment, this globe environment, and it allows you to create landforms and water bodies of water, and then populate that globe environment with creatures that are both predatory or like carnivorous or non-carnivorous, and the carnivorous predatory creatures will eat the non-carnivorous ones and continue to populate the species. It's like a little, it's basically like a world game.
You make your own ecosystem.
Yes, yes.
What's this game called?
It's called Topia. It's available for the for iOS. And there's not...
How much is it?
It's, I think it's either 99 cents or free. It's not that expensive at all. It's 99 cents. Yes, I'm looking at it right now. Okay, so it's 99 cents, and graphically, it's actually really sort of impressive for even for the iOS, and Although I will say that the gameplay isn't really fully built out. There's really not a lot to do other than building the landforms and populating them and watching the little creatures sort of do their own thing. But they promise that there are more challenges coming for that platform. And the other sandbox game I'm playing is literally called The Sandbox. And I guess it's a built out conversion of a game that's been going on for a long time online, which is basically like where you have an empty space and a bunch of elements that are represented by powders, and like a fire powder or a water powder or an earth powder, and you mix them up and see them react. And this company, Bulky Pix, has built that basic gameplay out and gamified it a little bit more and created challenges out of that. And that is also, I think that's for free on the App Store, with the option of buying some, optional in-app purchases. So those are the things that I've been playing with. What have you been playing with?
I've been playing with a couple things. So I guess last year, I said so already, I was working on organizing my video collection, mostly because my girlfriend was like, why is all this crap all around my house all the time? Mm-hmm. So I was working on that. This year, I've been working on my music collection and her music collection. So she had a stack of CDs. This is obviously a much easier situation than dealing with video. Mm-hmm. But she had a stack of CDs, probably, I'm 5'10", so probably as tall as me. And they were just kind of like in this cupboard. And every once in a while, you go in there, you hear the clickety-clack of the CDs. So given our one remaining computer with a CD drive, they're all going away, right? They're kind of getting out of whack. So I figured now was the time to do all that ripping. So I've done that. But the thing is, even if you have a CD, especially if you have an older one, they don't always get picked up by, iTunes or the other ripping tools in terms of CDDB or whatever. So I've been using this program, I think I mentioned it before, called TuneUp, and I've been using that to go listen to the Gracenote servers and kind of Shazam all the songs and put the right stuff in them. TuneUp has this deduper function, which is really helpful. Only problem is that it tends to run out of RAM. It doesn't use all the RAM of your machine. It has some artificial limit built into it or whatever. So I've got to do it piece by piece. So this last week, I've kind of been going through the audio books and the podcast. Yeah, not so much the podcast, but the general music. I've soundtracks from every anime under the sun, and trying to get that to sort of respect my situation. And it's good because now I've got, I think I've shaved 20 or 30 gigabytes of my actual music collection off because I had so many duplicates from just copying and pasting it all to different computers. And other than that, though, it's really good. Now, when it comes to games, I've been playing something that's pretty fun. I've been playing Strike Suit Zero. Devinger put me onto this game. It's basically, if you've ever heard of like Descent Free Space, or you've ever played any kind of space fighter flight simulator, that's what this game is. Mm-hmm. You're in an amazing, like, kind of like a Gundam style suit, but it mostly reacts like a fighter. And I've only played it for about an hour, but it's $15. It's on Steam. It runs on Windows machines, mm-hmm. and it you are part of those epic battles, those epic like X-wing, TIE fighter type battles. Just you've got missions, you're taking shit out. There's a good storyline, and it really reminds me of Descent Free Space, which is a fantastic game if you haven't played it before.
I'm looking at the video right now. Looks terrific. Looks like a sort of like, Gundam suit or some sort of, basically you're in the robot suit shooting things up sort of game. Yeah. So
it's immersive, and that's cool because I feel like I don't see a lot of those. I don't spend a lot of time in immersive games today. I've been playing things like, Subway Surfer or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then finally, one service I've been messing with is IITT has a music and video discovery recipe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's not the most amazing recipe. Basically, you get an email when some pilot has shown up or when some guy releases his single for free. You look at it, you click the button, you download it, but In the post iOS 5 world, where you can tell something to download to anything, I'll be on my phone, I'll hit download, and then when I'm at home or whatever, and I start playing music on my stereo system, it's there already anyhow. So that's kind of it kind of works, with that as a base. But I like it. I've discovered a couple new TV shows that continue. Andrew, you and I talked about Continuum, a Canadian
Sure.
sci-fi show that came out earlier this week, earlier last year in 2012.
With
I just Rachel Nichols.
Rachel Nichols.
Yeah, so
So lovely, that woman.
Oh,
She
really? I
would
feel
she
like she
was
looks like every other
Oh,
dark-haired sci-fi
I
woman
was
ever.
turned on to her. Yeah, she was I think she was first time I saw her was in the third or fourth season of Alias. I can't remember which one. She also played the green Orion
Slave girl in
slave
Star
girl in
Trek.
Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, she has a distinguished career, I guess. I would say that for me, the premise of the show is really cool. The idea that in the future, like a lot of times you look at, like, I don't know, it touches Blade Runner in a big way. And having been to New Delhi recently, which has a very Blade Runner, like, smoggy, dark situation in the wintertime, fog everywhere, huge buildings, red lights, all that stuff. Seeing this depiction of the future where the it's they really tried to lean on the whole 2011 Occupy Wall Street situation, and the idea that in the future terrorism is really about and social animus is really about people fighting against corporations and so on, and what happens when you live in our world where it's not so much a dystopia because it's the end of the world and it's been all destroyed like we normally see. It's a dystopia because some of the freedoms, like the SOPA type freedoms that we fought for
Sure.
last year, are not available to those individuals. And issues like privacy and freedom, general freedom, freedom of speech, privacy, the way government's structured, the Bill of Rights, it's all kind of been sucked up by the Super Citizens United world. And to me, that's really fascinating. And don't get me wrong, the acting is reasonable. I'm not going to sit here and diss Rachel Nichols, but I will say that the premise of the show is pretty interesting. And like all these shows, you watch a few episodes, you see if you want to see more of it, that kind of thing. I know it didn't turn you
Yeah.
on or whatever, but it was it's all right. So this IFTTT music and video discovery thing help me out because it'll tie you to Google Play or it'll tie you to
And IFTTT, for the people that aren't familiar, stands for if this, then that. And it basically allows you to connect services like Facebook and Google with like custom sort of recipes, almost like Yahoo Pipes.
Exactly. It's like Yahoo Pipes, but it's independent of anything, and people have to build the APIs into it. You can do all sorts of stuff with IFTTT. I have a Wemo, which is a Logitech-based device that turns on or off an electronic outlet, and that is controlled by IFTTT. So,
Let me bring Tosin in and we can dive into our headlines. Tosin.
hello, how are you guys?
Good, how are you?
Doing well, doing well.
We're just about to start digging into the headlines on our show.
Great.
Let's jump into the first headline here. And this is a continuation of a story we discussed last week, the Aaron Swartz story. According to WikiLeaks tweets, Aaron Swartz had at one time aided WikiLeaks in some indefinite way, had been in communication with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, and may have acted as a source for WikiLeaks. Their tweets, they tweeted last week about Aaron Swartz after the big news week involving his passing. And their tweets were, and I'm quoting here, "Due to the investigation into the Secret Service involvement with Aaron Swartz, we have decided to disclose the following facts. Aaron Swartz assisted WikiLeaks. Aaron Swartz was in communication with Julian Assange, including during 2010 and 2011. We have strong reason to believe, but cannot prove, that Aaron Swartz was a WikiLeaks source. The aim of these tweets could be to imply that the U.S. Attorney Office and Secret Service targeted Swartz in order to get at WikiLeaks, and Swartz died still defending his contacts' anonymity. Taking that implied claim at face value would be irresponsible without more evidence." However, these tweets add up to an extraordinary statement from WikiLeaks itself by doxing Swartz as an ally and possible source. WikiLeaks may have broken its own rules of anonymity. And the reason I bring this up is because, Dwayne, last week when we were talking about Aaron Swartz, you made the comparison of his actions to that of Julian Assange at WikiLeaks. And I thought fundamentally that was not necessarily an apt comparison, because I think Aaron Swartz wasn't doing what he did for the same sort of political motivations as Julian Assange. But as it turns out, he may have actually been allegedly working with the Julian Assange and WikiLeaks in that respect.
When I saw this, I wasn't as surprised as maybe many people were. I guess on some level, I guess I felt a little vindicated, but I would say that they're both people whose maxim is about getting information out to the people. And what I would think is, some people might call it, divisive or subversive, or a revolutionary thing that's kind of like anarchist or whatever.
Yeah.
But I look at it and I gotta say, there's something to be said about, in an age where the media panders to the viewer rather than like does real investigative reporting. This is one of those things where I have a lot of respect for these people for going out on a limb and trying to expose information that should be readily available to the public in a democratic society, to that public. So I think in the long run, when we look back at Swartz's legacy, I think that this will be another feather in his cap, if it's true.
I hope so too. I think the general consensus that Aaron Swartz had a lot of he had this tremendous potential ahead of him, and that was cut short by this by his situation, and so hopefully that will at least bring more sort of attention to his cause in general, and hopefully things will change because of that. Okay, so a year after the file storage site Mega Upload was brought down by U.S. law enforcement officials targeting piracy, flamboyant founder Kim.com has cut the ribbon on his new site, Mega. And that's at mega.co.nz, domain in New Zealand, where Kim.com is currently at. He says, not long after Mega was launched, he followed up with a tweet trumpeting what he said was the site's immediate popularity. Site's extremely busy, currently thousands of user registrations per minute. And Mega has passed 1 million users, according to Kim.com. Mega users will get 50 gigabytes of storage for free, and that his lawyers are working on giving former Mega Upload premium users their premium statuses on the new site. On top of the free storage, Mega, which offers encryption and is being touted as an awesome cloud storage service that will help you protect your privacy, offers three pricing plans with added storage space and bandwidth. I myself have registered on Mega.
I have too. I think their pricing plans are actually quite reasonable. Mm-hmm. 50 gigabytes for free, which is, you know, what Box does for people. And then 10 euros a month to up that to, I think, a terabyte or some crazy number like that, which is not too bad. And what that really means is that if you're someone like me who does have a big music collection, you can throw your music collection up there without an issue. You know, you just have that backup. You can't use it as a web server without having to spend a significant amount of money on the bandwidth, because that does cost money. Mm-hmm. But as a static backup, you know, cloud services, or I think in the future what he's planning to do is allow you to save directly from a download source into Mega, much like how on your mobile phone you can save documents directly into Dropbox via the Dropbox API. That's kind of exciting. What's really weird to me, though, is that he's trying to do a million things here with a Google Docs-type interface that allows you to write some stuff on there and some other things that we're seeing, too. So it looks like he's got a lot of irons in the fire. This is his attempt at going super legit with this stuff. So
now, Tosin, you linked us to a Ars Technica article that points out some of the questionable encryption on Mega.
Yeah, no, I found it a very interesting read. You know, of course, as you previously described, his flamboyant attitude, yes, in terms of, you know, this whole presentation and 1 million signups and all that. But when it comes down to it, I think the major push for a lot of people here is more the encryption and the security which they supposedly will provide. Because when it really comes down to it, as the years go by, space isn't really that commodity which everyone is going to be trying to get the most of, because it's going to be pretty cheap. You know, it's when you have other players like Google, you know, Box, of course, sure, and SkyDrive. I'm sure when it comes down to price, you have to differentiate yourself in other ways, right? And so
that's why he's putting all these random services on top of it, as if it's like a smorgasbord of services.
Exactly, which is not a bad thing to do, as long as that you are good with your core competency. And you know, typically the way it is you have one core competency and you build up towards it rather than starting with everything on, you know, all at once. But
it's the shotgun that's the problem. He's shotgunning. I mean, I wouldn't call it the problem. The worry is the shotgun, the idea that it's going to have, like, you know, direct connections into your Usenet stuff. And then it's also going to have your ability to write documents with the Office suite like Google Docs. And it's your 50 gigabytes. And it's this. It's kind of like watching one of those late night TV commercials about knives that can cut through anything. But wait, there's more. So there is a certain the flamboyancy is definitely taking away some of the credibility on the outset. Too good to be true.
Now, as far as that article, which looks at the state of Mega's encryption, mm-hmm, there are a lot of things which they find questionable in terms of how data is stored. How one of the points that I recall the article bringing up was that in part of their terms, it sounds like they have potentially algorithms in place so that they're not storing redundant data. But when you consider that, if something is purely and randomized, purely encrypted with a good randomized algorithm, well, then it should never be the same as anything else that's up there. So it makes you question, mm-hmm, how exactly are they encrypting. Is it encrypting with the sense of security that it's not something that someone could easily break? There's a lot. It goes into quite a lot of depth, and I definitely suggest reading that and checking it out. But I think the one good thing about Mega Upload's stance is that they want to sort of open source how they are encrypting and their algorithm, and kind of lead the public and allow the public to decipher what they're doing and, mm-hmm, potentially, mm-hmm, even assist them making it better. But we'll see when they first do that, you know, what sort of concerns or questions or objections come up, and if they're able to successfully navigate those waters.
Yeah, it's interesting because this encryption stuff, I've read that basically the way it's set up, where it's using your password to generate this encryption key, if you're hacked once, you're hacked for life, because that encryption key is hard, it's almost hardwired to your account. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm, that's a problem. When it comes to the million people who signed up the day of, I don't know about you, Andy. Were you able to get your handle, Mr. Baby Man?
I don't remember what I signed on, but I think I did. Yeah, I think. I mean, yeah, it's fairly.
I got Dwayne. So.
Oh, nice.
Whenever I hear that kind of thing, mm-hmm, like I usually I usually settle for Dwayne D, which is fine because it's branded and it's cool. But when I hear those kinds of things, I try to correlate it to what people are able to get as their handles, because most people have names that are fairly common, although I would say mine is fairly unique, so is Tosin's, and so is Dwayne's. Yeah. But I would say that it's rare for me to get Dwayne straight up. I usually can get Dwayne D. I have Dwayne D in most things. So I thought it was interesting that they had hit 1 million people, you know, a day ago. If the momentum had stuck around, I would not have expected to get that name and would have had to use something different. So it's not like I have a whole bunch of data and science to back that up, but it just kind of led me to put the veracity of the claim also tied to the super security mm-hmm. and the claims of all these awesome services that are going to show up leaves me excited about the possibilities, but also hanging out with a grain of salt.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I've uploaded some stuff to Mega, but it's all been sort of, it's all been like non-copyright and sort of tests. I've thrown a few test files in the water, so to speak, just to see how, you know, how, the ease of use. And I personally hope that this begins a new chapter for Kim.com away from this sort of dubious, shady reputation that he has into...
But I mean, how shady was he compared to so many people who've done so much stuff on the web, right? Like Sean Parker is an entrepreneur. He started shady with Napster.
Sure.
You've got the guys, you've got a whole party in Sweden or Finland, I forgot which country, that is the pirate party that's focused on making content free. You know, they're as you know, they are to the RIAA and the MPAA what Hamas is to the United States government. You know, like they're so like I feel like, is he shady? He certainly isn't not shady, but I feel like
he's no shadier than Sean
Parker. There's a lot of
people
out there doing things that are like are far more brazen than he is, so yes. to speak. You know what I mean?
And those people have a lot of those people have gone on to highly successful careers.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, just take, for example, sheer, you know, off-the-cuff example, Mark Zuckerberg, who's the, you know, the sort of provenance of Facebook has shady, has sort of dubious origins itself. So
yeah, I mean, even look at YouTube, right? YouTube yeah. got sued by Viacom the minute Google purchased them. Why did they get sued by Viacom the minute Google purchased them? Because Viacom realized that YouTube was making so much of its ad money off of clips of The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and other Comedy Central, aka Viacom properties, mm-hmm. that the minute they saw a multi-billion-dollar corporation snap them up and they realized there was a way to get their money back from people making advertising revenue off their content, they went after it. Now, I know some YouTube guys, and they're great guys. I mean, their service changed the world, just like Napster changed the world. That's why we have the iTunes Store, things like that. So it's just interesting to me that he's got this like Kim.com, who is, you know, he calls himself Kim.com. So there's something
to that. He flaunts it.
Yeah, he's as a flaunter or whatever. Yeah. He's definitely out there. He's a fringe. But I will say that it's interesting to see that we have to keep in perspective that so many things that we hold dear, that we are regular, the disruption started from a sketchy spot. Yeah. So if he can come through with an actual super encrypted mm-hmm. way to hold your stuff online, then like, cool, you know?
Yep. Okay, so the Federal Communication Commission's chairman, Julius Genachowski, wants to see gigabit speed broadband services in all 50 states by 2015. At a meeting of U.S. mayors in Washington, D.C., Genachowski called on municipal leaders and service providers to deploy gigabit speed broadband in at least one community in each of the 50 states in the next 2 to 3 years. I'm going to butcher this guy's name every single time I say it. Genachowski said that by participating in the Gigabit City Challenge, communities would turn themselves into innovation hubs that would create valuable jobs for its citizens. Currently, only 42 communities across 14 states already have ultra-high speed broadband. I think this is a this is a optimistic note that the FCC actually gets what needs to happen in the U.S. to keep it at least competitive across the globally with other countries like South Korea, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I read this and I've been in the last 3 weeks, I've been to India and to Mexico, and in like another week and a half, I'll be in Canada, and I think after that, I'm going to Asia. And I'll say that things are not fast everywhere. Like you think India, you think, you know, hub of technology and, you know, like connectivity and like, you know, when you call there, the Dell people are hopping on your computer with obviously crazy bandwidth speeds in order to get like to service your machine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I gotta say, like, for the average consumer, that is just not the case. It just isn't. You know, even in Mexico, which is, I mean, I was in a resort in Mexico. It was like a 4 or 5 star resort in Mexico. And they had Wi-Fi that came with the room, and it was like I had 4 bars, all the bars of Wi-Fi and whatever. And once I was on it, I did a speed test, and I had 0.01 megabit. Wow. I had enough to hang out and get some email, but I wanted to download a magazine on Next Issue, and it really didn't play out. So what I'm saying is I am happy that we have a government agency that's focused on making sure that we have the best of breed connectivity. Because when I'm back at home, like I breathe a sigh of relief about the fact that I can, you know, my LTE is zippy, even though it's an AT&T and not Verizon Super LTE, it's still really zippy. My Wi-Fi works perfectly when I want 4G. That's like way faster than the Verizon 3G. I'm really happy about that. These levels of connectivity, because it's only once you go abroad that you begin. And these are like the well-connected places, right? Like Calcutta, New Delhi, Cancun, things like that. Things that are designed to like appeal to Westerners. And you really do feel a little bit of like, geez, this is what they're working with, huh?
I don't know. It's hard to say, because then again, you hear of a lot of European countries where they have, you know, all these advancements in terms of internet connectivity and like other things, right? Like
when it comes to
wind
wireless,
power and well, okay. I'm not sure about wireless per se, but
when it comes to internet connectivity, Europe is not hanging out at crazy, ridiculous megabit speeds as a whole. You'll go to parts of like England, Denmark, France, wherever, right, and you'll get a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But just like us, it really depends on how much you want to pay for your bandwidth speed. And unfortunately for them, bandwidth, like gasoline, costs a hell of a lot more money. So what's available for the middle-class person in America remains really quite nice compared to basically everywhere except for Japan and South Korea.
Just to follow up on this, during Google's company earnings call this week, their CFO, Patrick Pichette, said that Google Fiber is not a hobby. He said, we really think we should be making good business with this opportunity. We're going to continue to look at the possibility of expanding. So the whole Kansas City thing is not an anomaly. They want to push it out across the country. And I think we discussed it on this show before that part of the hurdle for Google Fiber is that last mile build out, the cost of that last mile build out. But hopefully they can get to my neighborhood. That's all I care about.
Well, I mean, if you're in New York and you have access to Fios, you really can't be any happier than that. I mean, it's incredibly fast. You're just not wanting at all, with the exception of the fact that, you know, you have to have like a crazy weird box in your house. Pretty great.
I guess, you know what? I don't want companies being complacent, because I think that's really easy to become when you're in big industries where you don't really have too much competition. Right? You can kind of, and I think that's also something which you
well,
notice
really
when
lucky
a lot of
that
people.
You live... Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I think that's something which we kind of notice a lot of the times when you see the number of people who complain about certain services, like, you know, I'll toss out Comcast for now. There are a lot of people who complain about it, but they don't really – often they don't really have a suitable option regardless. So it's kind of like a null point, and it seems – you know, at least to me, it seems that sometimes things just don't change, or people aren't trying to change as fast. And I know it's a different perspective now, especially that I live on the West Coast in like Silicon Valley, where I see all these innovators and see a much faster pace. But it's like, that would be amazing if it's the sort of thing which we can get a lot of companies still trying to achieve and leverage. And I think that'd make, you know, the world a better place.
Yeah, there's no doubt. You're absolutely right. One of the things I've realized, though, is that there's a lot of luck involved in this. Chris Bernour lives in Sunnyvale, and he has an awful internet connection, and it's Comcast. I live in Boulder. I have a wonderful internet connection. It's also Comcast. There's a bunch of that going on. We're also lucky enough to live in a country where, you know, despite the local monopolies that are allocated by the local and state governments. So, like, you know, if you live in Brooklyn where Devinger lives and you're on one side of one of the main streets, Flatbush Avenue, you are in Cablevision Optimum Town. And if you're on the other side of the street, you are in Time Warner Cable Town. Whether it's the content you're getting to the cable provider or the bandwidth speed, you're locked in. You can't, they've got territories that they've been allocated, parceled out by the government. So Tosin, you're right. It's annoying to have to deal with that. You have to move if you want to get better service in some cases. But the interesting thing about that is that I would imagine for more than bragging rights, in that scenario specifically, those two companies fight it out on who's got the better bandwidth speed. And even though Cablevision is a kind of a regional provider, you don't really find Cablevision on the West Coast. They are constantly rated as one of the top speed, like, you know, top providers in terms of like internet speed for cable, more so than Time Warner. So it's interesting to see that, you know, the big super company Time Warner. I mean, Cablevision is very large. They own Madison Square Garden. They own whole sports teams. They're a big company. But you think the brand Time Warner, you think it's a bigger brand, has more of a household name, and it's Cablevision that's pushing them forward. To your point, Tosin, there's another company out there that's pushing those guys forward to be faster because they know people are saying, hey, this isn't fair. And they also know that if enough people get pissed off about the whole monopoly thing, they'll both lose their territories. So they've got to provide the best services possible without looking as if they're colluding together to just kind of like keep you limited.
All right. Moving on here. Dwayne, you brought this story to my attention. Steve Jobs had threatened patent litigation if Palm wouldn't agree to stop hiring Apple employees, according to a Palm CEO, Edward Colligan, in a statement dated last year. The allegation is backed up by a trove of recently released evidence that shows just how deeply Silicon Valley's no-hire agreements pervaded in the mid-2000s. There's a sort of a kind of a damning note here that Colgan says he received a call from Jobs in August of 2007 expressing concern about Palm's hiring of Apple's employees. He goes on to say that Jobs proposed an agreement between Palm and Apple that would stop the practice, also suggesting that, quote, if Palm did not agree to such an agreement, Palm could face lawsuits alleging infringement of Apple's many patents. Colligan responded in an email suggesting that any such agreement would likely be illegal and that Palm had patents of its own that it could use to countersue. Jobs replied, writing, I'm sure you realize that asymmetry in the financial resources of our respective companies when you say we'll both just end up paying a lot of lawyers a lot of money.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story to me. I mean, obviously there's the whole intellectual property thing, which is kind of my strong suit. But what's really interesting to me is that that Steve Jobs' personality wrote this down on paper. Yeah. Like, I know the guy was a man with a strong personality, a man who was focused, and, you know, he's very like Parker Lewis can't lose.
Yeah,
it's a coin of geek phrase. but it's astounding to me that he put this down on paper, that he emailed this to other people.
Pretty ballsy.
It's more than ballsy. It's kind of just it's bad judgment. it's just straight up bad judgment. In our country, when you have a lawsuit, you are compelled. When you're part of a lawsuit, there's a part called discovery where each side is compelled to answer the questions of the other side before you get to trial and to provide documents that support the interrogatories or just document requests. I want to see every single email having to do with Andy's new computer, right? Mm-hmm. And Andy is mandated by the government to give me every single email, even if one of those emails is damning. And that's what happened here. So as we look at this email, and it's on The Verge, and I'm sure it'll be in the show notes, he writes, it's not just a matter of our employees deciding that they want to join Palm. They're actively being recruited using knowledge supplied by John Rubenstein and Fred Anderson. That's the Palm guys. We must do whatever we can to stop this. He could have stopped right there, but he goes, I'm sure you realize the asymmetry and the financial resources. So basically saying, I'm sure you realize that our company is way bigger than your company.
We will outsue you, is basically what he's saying.
When he goes, because the other guy, he writes in, Colligan writes in, hey, you know, we're just going to end up spending a lot of money. Why would we even go that route? And Steve Jobs is like, I can spend the money. I have the money. Right. When you say we'll spend a lot of money on lawyers, I'm just going to say that I have the money. And this is part of that. The Verge rightly writes this down, that this is part of that nuclear, you know, Jeff Blagden puts this in there. He's the Verge reporter. It's part of that nuclear perspective that Steve Jobs seemed to have against those people who would compete and take aspects of the iPhone from Apple. We have to remember that from Steve Jobs' perspective, he saw Xerox PARC. He got the license to make the technology, and within a few years, Microsoft stole his thunder, ate his lunch, and perverted what he thought was going to be awesome. So when it comes to the mobile revolution that his iPhone started, when it came to these app-based smartphones, he saw these guys as a threat. He saw Android as a threat, and there was no way he was going to let the history of the Apple OS and Windows operating system be repeated. And when you look at this kind of thing, he's like, I'll go nuclear right now.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care. I have my finger on the trigger. This is DEFCON 4. I will crush you. And he goes on to talk about how the patents that they bought are crap compared to Apple's patents.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I do not believe that Steve Jobs actually knew whether or not those patents were crap. But part of our legal system is such that it doesn't always matter if you're right. Yeah. It matters if you have more money. You can bankrupt someone on legal fees.
Sure.
And I've seen this time and time again. So this is it's a pretty damning email in terms of the intent. Now, you know, Steve Jobs is gone. I don't know if Apple can be held completely liable if Tim Cook is shaking in his boots or anything like that. But I'm pretty sure a settlement will occur.
I thought that looking at a lot of these, The Verge has a stack of these email documents in their article, and they're pretty enlightening as to the whole like no recruit.
It's non-solicitation. We call it no recruit, but really the type of phrase you'd find is non-solicitation. The idea is that you can't solicit my dudes.
Right.
Now Apple could have been smart enough to actually like come into agreements and incentivize their competitors not to solicit their dudes. But the fact is we work in a country that has an open labor market. So I don't really know what they were getting at here.
But not only is it non-solicitation, but the other point is that across the board, a lot of these companies want to keep that sort of fact off the record. It's a total handshake. You know, Intel's Paul Alini says, let me clarify, we have nothing signed. We have a handshake, no recruit between Eric Schmidt and myself. I would not like this broadly known, and that's kind of the running theme for all of these companies is they do have these no recruit clauses, and they don't want them publicly known.
And right. That makes a lot of sense because they're colluding together, right?
Yeah.
If Tosin, you and I each have a company, right? Tosin's Intel, you're Apple, I'm Google. The fact is, if we went straight open market, free market on labor, and we're all competing with one another, we're suddenly going to be paying a lot more for labor than we would for the legal fees associated with these patent situations. Basically, Steve Jobs is paying his top people a significant amount of money. And if those top people can be picked up by Google, as we've seen before, right? We've seen Google or Facebook or some other company spend ridiculous amounts of money on buying the company just to get the talent or usurping the talent for like millions of dollars. Suddenly, you know, that $100 billion of cash Apple has on hand is a little less as people realize they can go back and forth. And Apple is, from their perspective, the management of Apple feels as if it's held hostage by the workers. And the workers realize that loyalty to Apple isn't exactly everything that they're looking for. If you can make a quick buck somewhere else. And then you have a culture of churn, which is something that Apple doesn't want. Apple wants its different teams right. completely invested in the property, right? So it becomes a big culture problem. So you can, again, see why he'd be so virulent mm-hmm. about this issue.
Yeah, I mean, no, Tosin, I mean, it's definitely right
now, yeah.
It's definitely something which you know is exists probably, you know, I would say it exists a lot larger than people believe it. Mm-hmm. Like with a lot of other players, not just, you know, all these tech companies in the Valley or in California and Seattle, but all over the country with some deep-seated organizations. It's just that, of course, they don't the individuals at top don't write it down, or at least when they do write it down, it's not in a, you know, it's scribbled on a piece of paper. Yep. It's whispered in someone's ear. It's not something.
But I mean,
that,
why would you write it down if you didn't have to? If you're one of like six guys, right? You're Sergey or Steve or Larry or Eric. You know these people by first name. And you're going to be like, dude, we don't want to get into this because, like, I'm going to take your dudes. It's mutually assured destruction. There's going to be chaos. The minute you write it down is the minute you're actually seen as colluding. And the yep. minute you're seen as colluding, you know, to change the way the labor market works, the minute everybody looks terrible. The worst part about it all is that everyone looks terrible anyway.
Yeah. Now, granted, you know, this is the thing that happens when companies start also getting really upset with one another. They start breaking these unwritten rules, and exactly. that's how you get into this position where, okay, an email actually gets shot off. And I could definitely see Steve Jobs doing this from, you know, just knowing his personality and knowing some of the emails he has sent out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess it doesn't really surprise me that much. And It's a very interesting look that all this paperwork was produced and leaked out, but
yeah, it's clear that this. I mean, it also, I think for a lot of us, you know, there's not a lot of tech reality TV or other such gossip for people like the three of us and, sure. and so many others. So there is something to the idea that like, oh, we have like some insight into like these actual personalities and what was going on and all that other stuff. So there's definitely something to that as well.
We take it where we can get it. Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I want to talk about today is one that I've been looking forward to for a long time. It's called Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief by Lawrence Wright. Now, Lawrence Wright is a journalist who has written some pretty damning articles about Scientology before, previously in The New Yorker, involving director Paul Haggis, who had famously left Church of Scientology out of disgust, essentially. This book is based on more than 200 personal interviews with both current and former Scientologists, both famous and less well-known, and years of archival research. Lawrence Wright uses his extraordinary investigative ability to uncover for us the inner workings of the Church of Scientology. We learn about Scientology's complicated cosmology and special language. We see the ways in which the church pursues celebrities such as Tom Cruise and John Travolta, and how such stars are used to advance the church's goals. And we meet the young idealists who have joined the Sea Org, the church's clergy, signing up with a billion-year contract. So, yeah, I've been looking forward to this book for a long time. It's supposed to be really juicy and in-depth. This is
it like, a new release?
A new release, yes. This is the epitome of like the perfect summer reading book. Yeah, it was just released on the 17th.
So you're going to wait until summer to read it?
Well, I'm going to wait till I get my next Audible credit. And then it's going straight to the top of my reading pile.
Gotcha. You know, it's interesting when I hear your description, the description that's laid out as a book, from the book, you know, the idea that like, oh, they go after the celebrities and so on and so forth. When you look at Scientology, what's really interesting to me is that it's not actually very different from a lot of big religions. It's really all about getting those big people to solidify your cult and turn it into a religion. Because in the end, every religion is a cult before it's a religion. So I'm interested in reading that too, because I want to see if there are any tactics. Because you always understand that that's the strategy, right? You get Richard Gere into Buddhism. Buddhism suddenly isn't weird. Buddhism is a thing, and people do yoga. And now, like, you know, yoga is all over the place. You know, you're in Boulder. Yoga is every time you turn around the corner. There's more. The only thing that there's more than yoga in Boulder is marijuana shops. So there's that. But you know, like, you get like a Richard Gere, and suddenly you're what's seen as a cult, what's seen as on the outside, on the fringe, is now, you know, mainstream. Like, you know, you see the president playing a saxophone, and it's not just for those jive talking, like, you know, Negroes from South, you know, Louisiana or whatever.
Sure.
You know, it's one of those things. So, like, even Christianity, right? They were feeding those guys to the lions in the pits. And then suddenly Constantine, the emperor was like, oh, I guess I'm going to be Christian because like, I want to win this battle. That's what I figured out. And then suddenly Rome is Christian, and so is the rest of Europe. So it's interesting to see that. I think if I think about it myself, the big mistake that Scientology chose was Tom Cruise. And what's his name? Saturday Night Fever guy. So John Travolta. Like, if they had gone with Richard Gere, it would have worked out so much better.
So this book or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles can be yours for free, plus the 30-day trial. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. And when you go to that site, you are helping our show out. If you've never joined Audible before, you should absolutely try it out. It's great. I've, you know, changed the way I consumed books. I now listen to them more than I read them, and it's so easy for me when I'm doing other things like working or driving. So there you go. audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music, and when we return, Firefox OS phones, BlackBerry 10. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Tom Cruise is so in love with Katie. At least all his people tell him so. And while he thinks that she's a very special lady, it's probably not the way he'd choose to go. But a lifetime of longing looks would cause too much distraction. Good thing that he's not gay anymore. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Unifwakin. And let's talk about Mozilla. Mozilla has unveiled two developer preview phones that demonstrate its forthcoming Firefox OS system. Created by Spanish company Geeks Phone, the Keon and the Peak aren't game changers, but offer a glimpse of what's to come from Mozilla. The Keon is smaller orange-colored offering for developers running one of Qualcomm's 1 gigahertz Snapdragon CPUs with a 3.5-inch touchscreen. It's smaller than Galaxy S3 Mini and wields a 3-megapixel camera, 4 gigs of storage, 512 megabytes of RAM, and Wi-Fi. It's not going to set the developer's world alight, but it's not designed to do that. The larger handset is the Peak, which runs 1.2 gigahertz dual-core Snapdragon S4 CPU, also offers 4 gigs of storage and 512 megabytes of RAM, 4.3-inch display, and 8-megapixel camera, making it considerably more desirable for those looking to tinker with the Firefox OS. They'll be carrier unlocked, with over-the-air updates being sent regularly to the Firefox OS. The OS will be using a web system that frees it from proprietary platforms, allowing developers and eventually users accessing info and apps across multiple devices. No prices or launch details have been given yet, though the Keon will start shipping in February. And I took a look at these.
That's fast, guys. February, like, announcement.
Yeah.
Today in February for the launch. I mean, that's really fast.
It's like Apple speed.
Right. He wrote the article, Devinger. If he were here, he'd say, this is Apple speed. He'd say, this is really quick.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys saw the Mozilla Seabird concept phone video from 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys saw that, but I mean, Andy, you know that I hate concept videos.
Yeah.
I just want them to make it. But this concept video had a whole bunch of new concepts, the Seabird. And the idea of a Mozilla phone back then was like, what? That doesn't make any sense, really? Interesting to see that 3 years later, in 2013, they've actually got the phones, you know, like together, ready to ship and out there. And they're using this web-focused OS system. This system that is reminiscent of what WebOS may have been supposed to be. So that's exciting.
Yeah, no, I think this is kind of an indication of the fact that it is kind of a free-for-all at this point. I think with how sort of I don't want to say stagnant's almost too negative a term, but with how unchanging iOS has been, and the flux that Windows Phone has been going through, as well as who knows what's going on with BlackBerry or other developers, that it's kind of opened the gates for anyone to kind of jump in and sort of try their hand at phone OSs. And it's nice to see Firefox taking a step in there and looking pretty good so far.
And Firefox has spent some time hanging out with mobile. They do have mobile browsers out there for Android, things like that. So they've been thinking about it. I'm glad to see that Mozilla has really kind of embrace the fact that the internet will not be consumed via the web. The internet will be consumed not via the desktop web, but the web on mobile.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if they want to survive, they're going to have to pivot in this way. And as weird as this might sound to some people, this is really where so many things are going.
Yeah.
That tiny screen is really, when you're in bed and it's 4 o'clock in the morning and you turn the brightness all the way down so your partner doesn't wake up and you pull it out and you're reading.
You have just described eerily accurately, like every evening for me when I go to bed.
That's what happens. This screen is this is the intimate baby. And Mozilla, who, I mean, let's face it, they cracked the code on the web in 2002, 3, and 4, right? We were all sitting there with our Internet Explorer 5 or Internet Explorer 6, like humdrum,
yes.
Microsoft, where do you want to go today?
And shackled was like, to IE.
Exactly. or and Mozilla cracked the code. So, I mean, they may not be new to the party on the mobile thing, but I just suspect that at the very least from the tinkerer perspective, there's going to be something exciting in these devices.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys think this is going to compare to, you know, all the Android offerings out there as well as the iPhone offerings? Do you think there's a niche, or do you think that this may rise innovation?
This phone is for Chris, man. This phone is for this phone. These phones seem like they're for the tinkerers. And I think what's going to happen is they're going to show if the developers embrace the platform, because the platform is based on these standards that they're saying that they're based on, then we'll see growth in a big way.
Yeah, I almost wish either Chris or Devendra were here to comment on this, because Chris definitely has the expertise and an opinion in as far as open source
development.
Development, and Devendra is definitely the mobile guy amongst us. So it's a shame that they're not here, but it's nice to see this going on. And speaking of upcoming OSs, with BlackBerry 10's official launch just around the corner. Site Boy Genius Report happened on a few photos of the final gold master of the operating system running on a BlackBerry Z10 handset, thanks to a close source at BlackBerry. I've got about 100 photos of the phone's operating system in full detail. The images detail everything from the setup of a new BlackBerry 10 device to the settings menu to new home screens to RIM's Siri-like voice control system. I check some of these out. And, it's going to be interesting. I think we're going to be talking more about this next week when BlackBerry officially launches, to see if... this is going to be the make-or-break moment for RIM. Are they going to be able to stay and stay competitive amongst all the other mobile OSs? Or will this be their swan song?
So we'll know. It's actually really interesting to consider.
This is for the RIM faithful, don't you think?
Like, well, go ahead. Yes and no. I think on one hand, you know, one thing I think we failed to think about is internationally too. Mm-hmm. Like, all in Nigeria, that's typically, you know, what is it called? B2B messaging? Is that how – I can never remember the acronym. But BlackBerry's messaging system. That's what
BlackBerry Messenger, yeah.
Right.
Spend a lot of time in Nigeria, Tosin Anafowokun?
I originally from Nigeria, so I was there last summer. Everyone is on BlackBerry devices, especially internationally. I think this, of course, is going to revitalize that to a certain extent. Now, I was actually talking to a few colleagues of mine who saw the screens, and they were like, you know what? I could potentially see myself going back to a BlackBerry device. So I think there is that chance. Now, you know, on the opposite spectrum of that, mm-hmm. This really needed to happen a long time ago. Yeah. And you best be doing something really cool and innovative, mm-hmm. if you want to be able to take a chunk out of the current market segment.
You can't just keep up with the Joneses. You have to surpass the Joneses at this point.
Especially when you're starting this far behind.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I got to say, for me, yeah, you got to like the BlackBerry faithful, the guys in Nigeria, or just like the corporate situations where the systems administrators have been like, no, we're sticking to a platform that we control centrally. It's not bring your own device. It's what we want, and BlackBerry is it. Mm-hmm. Yep. They have to impress those guys first and foremost. Right, those, because they're hoping for those to maintain their big contracts with these big corporations. They have the security, they have the infrastructure, they have all this stuff that, you know, if you're a systems administrator in a financial institution or some other heavily regulated situation, this is key. So BlackBerry really has to do that, because they're getting so much pressure from their employees to let them bring their own devices and deal with security and you know, app this and app that and yada, yada, yada. I mean, Apple's all right, but it's still not the BlackBerry they know and love and can control. I got to say, with companies like Huawei and ZTE coming out of China, India, wherever, with cheap Android devices, you know, I'm hanging out in – I was in 2 10-million people cities, and all I saw were Android devices with the exception of, you know, an iPhone on a wealthy person's hand.
Interesting.
So they're – you know, smartphones are out there in the hands of lots and lots of people. The middle class of that huge nation has them. When I was in Mexico the other day, the middle class of that not so huge nation also had smartphones, whether it was Android or whatever. There are people.
You know what?
People who still love their BlackBerries, and I think that if they can gain traction with their base, then people will look over the shoulder of those people who have the new BlackBerries and be like, oh, what is that? Because I think Andy's right. There's a moment here where Windows is pushing through with its phone based on the tie-in with the new OS. Mm-hmm. Apple, I wouldn't say Apple's not faltering, but Apple has become a standard as opposed to a super leader. They're making a ton of money. They're making like 75% or some crazy number of the profits when it comes to these smartphones. And you see them everywhere. You get on an airplane, everyone's got an iOS device. I'll give you that.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is that there is something that I think a lot of individuals have found relatively mundane about Apple's design and layout. Oh, it's an iPhone. It's what everybody else has. I'm looking for something different. And I feel like that's BlackBerry has a chance to have one foot in the established super businessy side and another foot in the, hey, look, we're new and different side. You know our brand name already, and we're new and different. So I think they have a chance if they get this right.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting when you go explore the business marketplace because on one hand, BlackBerry has that security and has that whole model out. And if they can leverage that, that's going to be huge for their device. But then on the other hand, you know, CEOs are now becoming the primary decision makers rather than the, you know, IT infrastructure. And a lot of CEOs like things that just work and that are pretty sexy, pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you see a major switch over to, you know, Apple devices as far as,
although
the,
you know, BlackBerry
iPhones
always worked.
And,
the BlackBerry did always, to a certain extent. It never didn't work. It's just that it came to the iPhone, it was just the app ecosphere just ate it up.
Yeah.
I think the BlackBerries were also just really clunky, and there were times where, if you recall, when like the BlackBerry infrastructure would go down.
Yes, that is bad.
And then like you are just at the mercy of them. So that's another thing. But it's definitely going to be something really interesting to see, you know, a month after it comes out.
Well, there's a lot of turnaround here too. They had two CEOs for a while. They had the software guy. You know, like the company itself is showing us that it's trying to do something different, something worthwhile, because it didn't do that before. And I feel like it's really important that they get this at least the launch correct on that level.
All right, we have one final story here to finish our evening off. A little bit of a sad one. Today, as we record, which is Wednesday, the 23rd, an employee letter went out to everyone at game developer THQ. And it said, to all THQ employees, we now have the answers we've been seeking through our financial restructuring and Chapter 11 case. While much will be written, here are the facts of the bids and auction that occurred. Yesterday morning, we received a competing bid for the operating business, along with numerous offers for separate assets. During an auction process that lasted over 22 hours, the final conclusion is the separate asset bids would net more than a single buyer for the majority of the company. We expect that most employees of the entities included in the sale will be offered employment by the new owners. However, we cannot say what these new owners may intend, and there will be likely some positions that will not be needed under the new ownership. If you are an employee of an entity that is not included in the sale, we regret that your position will end. So THQ, I don't know if you guys are familiar, but THQ was founded in 1989. And they are probably most recently famous for the Saints Row series, Company of Heroes, WWE series, Homefront, Warhammer 40,000 series, Destroy All Humans series. And plus, through their licensing, they had distributed just basically you name it. They held a lot of sort of third-party IPs, like Disney and Nickelodeon, and you know, a lot of
the Company of Heroes game, I feel like, was every character was like a spin-off of, you know, a Marvel character or whatever. Mm-hmm. In order to get it done based on the Disney situation.
So those games are now, like, some of the games that they developed themselves, Company of Heroes is going to Sega, Saints Row is going to Koch Media, Homefront's going to Crytek. Seeing an entire publishing company dissolved is not something that happens very often in the gaming industry. And I personally remember seeing the THQ label on a ton of games as I was growing up playing. And so it's kind of sad to see the end of an era for this label.
This consolidation is so weird, right? Like,
yeah.
It definitely is. If you get a chance, I think they may still have some of those games in a Steam pack. They had some Christmas sales, mm-hmm. and as well as THQ pack was also included as part of Humble Bundle, one of the earlier Humble Bundles at the end of the year, and made sure to pick up some of those games to live in those memories. I know a lot of people who really like the latest Saints Row. I think it's a pretty hilarious game. They've definitely put out a lot of quality content, and it's always sad to see change. But, you know, I hope that the companies that have acquired these labels do them justice, as well as do justice to the employees that hopefully they will take on. Retain, it sounds like they're retaining a majority of them, but you know, you never know. So
at least for a little while, right?
Yeah,
until they transition. It's strange because oftentimes you see these. I mean, I read the statement that you read, it says it like straightforward, but oftentimes you see sort of wholesale purchases of the catalog.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded, I'm sure you guys have seen like other people's money and everything like that.
Yeah.
Of this idea that like, okay, we're just going to break the company up. Like it's like Andy said, it's dissolved. Mm-hmm. So it's not even a question of it's going to be a sub label to somebody else. It's dissolved. Like these people aren't making this company, this entity doesn't exist anymore. And it's a hard thing to see in the software business. I mean, someone's getting paid here. That's cool. But especially if you're part of that company's culture, I guess, is the thing that's going to go away. You think of Google, you think of its doodles, you think of like, you know, Microsoft, you've got the Redmond culture, you think of all that stuff. These guys just aren't around. So that's definitely showing a sign of the times. We're also seeing that like there's a lot of consolidation going on in the gaming industry, right? It's really stuck between Activision and EA with like a couple other guys out there like Sega, still alive, that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm hoping that some of these more indie games that, you know, Andy's been so great at like describing to us throughout the last year and a half are able to, those little brands, those little, those guys are able to, to use a situation like this and get some talent out of it from anybody who gets laid off and to grow and become, you know, new.
All right. Any other stories you want to touch upon before we sign off for the night?
On a high note, today is the 23rd of January, 2013, which means for many lucky Pebble owners.
Oh, yes.
The Pebble device went out today, and people should be seeing those shipments coming in relatively soon. All that waiting has really paid off, so that's really good.
They said they shipped about 500 units today, I think.
500 of 80,000, great.
It's a start.
That's all you could ask for. There was a story today about a gentleman who sued the Kickstarter guys. Not Kickstarter the company, but some individuals. Yeah, a Kickstarter idea was put up, and the product, I forget what it was. Maybe Tosin, you can fill in the gaps. But basically, it was $50. You pay $50, you get this product. A couple weeks later, we need $20 for shipping in America, $30 in Canada, unclear internationally. And the guy's like, huh? Okay, so he does that. He realizes he's never going to get what he got, what he thought he was going to get. And he looks at the Kickstarter rules, realizes that Kickstarter is not to blame at all. It's about the people with the idea who's selling themselves on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And then he realizes that the way they sold themselves on Kickstarter was not the way you're supposed to sell yourself on Kickstarter. Kickstarter, you say, I have an idea. I'm hoping that with your contribution, I can take my idea to the next level. But these guys said, if you give me money, I will give you your product. Like, as if it were an online store. Like it was a pre-order and not an investment. And so he was able to successfully like get money back from this dude who was apparently, you know, broke despite taking $35,000 from Kickstarter. So I'll shoot the email to you, Andy. You can put it in the show notes. But I think it's a pretty interesting way to look at the whole Kickstarter phenomenon and to show you kind of, even if you're going to be late on your product, like Pebble was, do it right. You know, like communicate with the people who invested in you. Let them know.
Yes. There's at least one Kickstarter project that I've invested in that I have no hope in whatsoever because they, although they're still technically active, I haven't heard an update from them in, I would say at this point, about a year. So,
oh, wow.
Have you emailed them?
I haven't recently. I haven't really, you know, it's one of those, I'm kind of, I don't know.
You're broken up about it.
I'm broken up about it. I'm done. done. But that, you know, when you invest in Kickstarter, you take on like a sense of responsibility that you're investing in a risk. You're investing in a project, not investing in a product. So you can't always expect that you're going to get a product back out of you. It's not a store. You're investing in getting these projects off the ground, and the rewards are just that. The rewards are not, you know, things that you're necessarily expecting to receive.
Yeah.
But yeah. But on the other hand, I definitely think that you have to hold these guys up to some level of expectation, in order to you know, make sure that they're following through on their project overall.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we haven't heard horror stories at a Kickstarter, I don't think, in any kind of significant way. But it's just something to think about. This is an investment. So I'm Pebble. I'm so glad that you guys communicated so well, and I really look forward to seeing my orange little Pebble watch.
I got red.
I was gonna get red, and then they showed up with orange. I was like, ooh, I like orange.
I went basic black.
Yeah,
goes with everything.
Yeah, you know I can't wear black. It doesn't look good on me.
I always bet on black.
Oh, okay, Wesley Snipes.
Oh, snap.
You have back problems too?
Last thing I want to cover today is a great day. It's National Pie Day.
And I saw your Facebook post.
That was National Pie Day. I thought that was 3/14.
That is pie, but not pie.
Pie, so, P-I-E.
But not P-I, right? So today's National Pie Day. Yeah. If you haven't gotten a chance... Or hopefully you've already got a chance to celebrate. Get yourself some lovely pie, be it apple.
I haven't, but I'm definitely – now that you mentioned it.
I've been missing out on this day for a long time. Yeah. I just look at the pie day with 314, and I turn the numbers around, and it spells P-I-E, so I go buy pie.
Well, you
so
know,
any day could be pie day.
There's never a bad occasion to buy pie, so go out and celebrate.
All right.
Maybe on cake day. That might be a problem.
Okay, so Dwayne, where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. And I'm contributing to some stuff from Planet.tv. Sorry. So you should be able to see some of my stuff there in the near future. I'm mostly giving suggestions.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast. Like the bread, TOAST 4321, as well as you can find me podcasting about movies and other random stuff on IRCwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, gplus.to/MrBabyMan, and Twitter, Facebook. Just do a Google search for Mr. Babyman and you'll find me. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you'll find our subscribe to us on iTunes. Go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar, upper right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher. We're at facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Somewhere in some secluded castle, poor Tom Cruise sits staring at the wall. And the outside world is always such a hassle. Sometimes he won't go out at all. There are millions who know his his name? Everybody loves him. Why is it that he feels so alone? Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise crazy. Just be glad it's him, not you. If you had Tom Cruise's troubles, you might be Tom Cruise crazy too. You'd flash your big white shiny smile, you'd buy expensive shoes, but you'd be the only man on earth who couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise. Oh no, you couldn't enjoy Tom Cruise.